My name is Karina Harney, Playboy's Playmate of the Year, 1992.
And I'm Echo Johnson, Miss January, 1993. Welcome to the Bunny Chronicles. Let's go.
Hi, Karina.
Hello, Echo. How you doing today, honey?
Excellent.
You look gorgeous.
You look gorgeous. Look at, gosh, we have the best makeup artists.
Yeah, do you like our makeup? Yeah,
yes, yes. We have a wonderful guest, Larry Logan.
Uh-huh. Super excited. So Larry Logan was a contributing photographer from 1977 to 1984 for the magazine, and then vice president, creative director in the entertainment group of PEI from 1984 to 1994. And then... Those were the years, right? 1977 and 94.
Okay. And that wasn't exactly your plan, I imagine. I feel like maybe you transitioned from one thing to the next. How did that come about? How did you
During the Playboy years?
Yes, during the Playboy years. Sure. In fact, let's just start from the top.
Yeah, let's start from the beginning.
With your whole start with Playboy. How did you end up in the Playboy family?
There you go. It really goes to when I was in at university and two different schools. I was doing off-campus assignments for a number of professional magazines. And at that point, it actually got about 500 magazine credits. So when I was in Santa Barbara finishing up on my second degree at Brooks Institute, Carrie Morris, who was the studio manager at Playboy Studio West, was aware of my work. He was ahead of me in school. And when I got out of school, shortly thereafter, he said, "Why don't you come on board?" You know, and had an interview. It was interesting. I think my photojournalistic background was probably helpful. Mm-hmm. because with Hef, you know, and sort of being ultimately sort of being his personal photographer, then you sort of have to have that background. Most of the other photographers were more studio trained, as you two ladies well know.
Right.
And so it was more of, you know, kind of how do you be a fly on the wall and have those journalistic, you know, background. And so that's how I really got started with the company. And then over some number of years, as the entertainment group developed, there was another part of my background, which really had to do with also in marketing and in design. And as the entertainment group started to come together, I really sort of transitioned sort of in a consultant role to the entertainment group, and would look at the artwork and the programming, and would have a point of view, which the company appreciated. And so, at that point, then I took on the role of vice president, creative director, and did that for the next 10 years, reporting to Hef.
That's wow. Awesome. Tell us what that's very cool to come out of Brooks. And actually, you're the second one. Arne Freytag was on the show yesterday, and he also came right out of Brooks and right into Playboy. So that obviously speaks for itself that Brooks Institute is phenomenal.
Yes.
But to go right into being Hef's personal photographer, I mean, what was that like? Were you excited? Were you nervous?
And how did you get that position exactly?
It was anticipated when I came on board. For the first little bit of time, I assisted the other photographers. Mm-hmm. I had known Arne, assistant Philip Dixon, a few of the other Pompeo, a few of the other photographers to kind of learn and get comfortable around nudity, mm-hmm. But also in terms of just, you know, the way the system worked in terms of the photographic assignments. And then what was coming up one night, Hef was going to be at the Playboy Club. And then Don Rogers, who was head of PR on the West Coast, just said, "Okay, it's time. So come tonight, you know, photograph Hef." And then I did. And again, covered him as a photojournalist would. And the next day, I got a call from Don. He said, "Well, for better or worse, you're it." And so there's something about Hef had made a comment that I think he felt comfortable with my approach. And he was really interesting all that time, you know, very much was aware in terms of when he was being photographed and the photographer and kind of that relationship. So at the very beginning, I think we just kind of clicked in that way.
Yes, we heard the story, mm-hmm. how you were taking photos, and he even remembered six months later
yeah.
how many frames were yeah. shot.
That one's missing.
Mind-blowing. But that was Hef. That was his attention to detail. That was his photographic memory. It was just one of the many mm-hmm. attributes that he had that made him such a phenomenal human being and made the brand yeah. so, I mean,
what it
the
was.
Magazine, what it was, and Playboy.
if you'd like, I mean, I could share two stories on his memory.
I mean,
definitely. But 1 second, and we just because we can edit this. Watch your hand when you're hitting the desk because it's really loud in our audio.
I wish he could hear us yeah. right now,
well,
so he knows
can hear
to edit.
So he'll edit it out.
But edit
anyway,
this out.
But anyway, yeah. So go ahead.
Well, an example, one of two examples of his incredible memory was that we were off to. For the Playboy Jazz Festival. Mm-hmm. And it was a large group on the bus. We came back on the bus, all of his friends and celebrities. We come off the bus, we walk into the mansion. Hef turns to his right, and Sandra, Theodore's little dog, was there. Hef goes over, he goes down on one knee, starts to pet the dog on the top of the head. I forgot the name of the dog. And so that's fine. I'm shooting a couple of different frames. It was a nice moment. So got a couple of shots. Months later, Hef calls me and he says, Larry, we're missing a shot. I said, okay. And he says, when I started to reach down to pet the dog on the head and I started to lean forward and there was one flash that went off at that point and I'm not seeing that photograph.
Wow. He said it like that detailed?
That detailed.
If
you're a photojournalist, often you will remember that. And when I edited the film and I said, Hef, your eyes were closed. So I pulled the piece of film out.
You blinked.
You didn't see that slide. Deleted yeah. it. And he said, okay, in the future, though, if you would, leave all the outtakes. Because, again, somewhere he might have remembered there was a photograph.
That's amazing that he's like, in the very beginning, I went down and there was a flash.
I know.
He knew exactly yeah. the moment.
I mean, he knew like there was five frames and frame number four is missing.
Wild.
Wow. Yeah. Wow.
I'll give you the other example was also by my training was really also an architectural photographer. So mm-hmm. I had assisted Julia Shulman, who's the world's greatest architectural photographer. I was doing that even while I was at school. And so at one point for Hef, I said, you know, why don't I photograph the mansion in Architectural Digest style,
yeah.
which I had been trained to do. And so I did that. And then and it worked fine, you know, worked for some number of days and nights photographing. It was time to photograph his room or his suite, let's say. And so, you know, on two different levels there, mm-hmm. Sort of living quarters on mm-hmm. one level mm-hmm. and above that, a work area for mm-hmm. him. Before I could do that, one, I had to wait till he would be out of town on a trip that maybe it was okay, I won't go on that trip. To stage the photography, though, the butlers had to go in and photograph every square inch with Polaroid cameras. Wow. And so if there was a stack of videotapes, if there was a pad and there were four pencils that were aligned a certain way.
They better be there.
Every square inch had to be photographed. Mm-hmm. And then I would go in for two full days. Did all the coverage, would leave, and they would have to go back and mm-hmm. with the Polaroids, put every single thing down, exactly skewed, exactly how it was stacked. Because his photographic memory was such that he would walk into the room, and if there was something off, something that was slightly turned, that he remembered that was the stack of videos, that was the way the papers were, that was this over here, that it sort of throw him.
Off.
I mean,
yeah.
because he
yeah.
had it so well mapped, even though it was constantly changing.
That's
and dynamic.
Really interesting. I love that. Thank you for sharing that the butlers had to go in and photograph. Like, that's wild.
Fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
Another interesting.
Very.
That's an interesting thing. I had no idea.
Yeah.
It was like, well, the butlers were telling us too. So we had asked them, did you ever, there was three of them at one time that came in. And we asked them, did you ever like get in trouble for Hef? And they all said, oh yeah. And so, but Brian Olea was one and he had just started and he, you know, was in Hef's room and he was like, God, right? He had these pillows he has are so thin and worn out. Like he has tons of money. He needs new pillows. So he went and got new pillows. And Mary like called him up and she's like, you better have those old pillows. Yeah.
Those were his.
Don't ever, ever, ever like mess with what he has and his setup.
His system.
It was a challenge for him. I mean, at different times, you know, candidly, it would be, it'd probably be good to refresh the mansion. And if you think about, you know, the large, as you know, the large parties and the number of people, very much of it was a public house in so many ways. And therefore, there's going to be over time, you know, sort of abuse to the furniture. It's going to get
wear
worn
and
a certain
tear.
Extent.
So that's
for him,
why, because I always wondered why was something never, ever updated in there? The carpets were so worn out and the med table. And that's why the towels were the same.
It was constant. I mean, every single day. But for Hef, it was also... It was really sort of change. I mean, in some ways he could accept change, but in so many other ways, it was his comfort level. Yeah. That's where everything is.
Yep.
You know, please don't change.
Right down to the colors and everything. Wow.
And it's really what made so many things work, that side of him. Mm-hmm. But then that, you know, that's a difficult thing to deal with.
Well, like Bill Farley told us earlier, you know, as brilliant and genius of a man as he was, there was things that, you know, he wasn't very keen on and couldn't relate to, such as taxes being taken out of a check for a commercial he did for Carl's Jr. It was like, well, where's the rest of the money?
It's
Bill's like, well, this is what happens every 2 weeks. We get our checks. And he goes, well, how can the government take that out of your check? It was so funny.
It was interesting. You're so right. I mean, a lot of the day-to-day things that we do. But there was one interesting thing where he sort of connected to his past. He had this beautiful Mercedes, I think it was a 300 series convertible that, you know, from the 50s that he had when he first made it big. And it was stored outside of the mansion. And at some point he said, you know, I think I'll sell it because it's been in storage for so long. I think Rob Report in the various magazines said, you know, it was going to be worth a small fortune.
Sure.
And so I spoke with Mary and for the magazines to sell it, I said, okay, I'll take some photographs. So we had it there in front of the fountain at the mansion in the circle there. And I said to Mary, you know, why don't you ask the boss to come down? I'll take some photographs, old time sake, getting behind the wheel. Hef comes down. And so, you know, Hef, you know, behind the wheel, he gets behind the wheel and then he reaches down and he starts the car up. Now, that wasn't intended. I mean, I had a couple of photographs of him looking over his shoulder and, you know, a nice shot.
Yeah.
He starts it up, puts it in gear, starts to drive in around and around
the
fountain
circle.
In the circle. He goes underneath, as you know, underneath the archway toward the back.
Right.
Security's jumping, open the gate.
Yeah.
And now they're also scrambling.
Get the chase cars.
Get the chase cars.
So
he knows where he's going.
Yeah.
So he's gone for, you know, I'm kind of standing there going, well, I'm not going to jump in the chase car. Let's see what happens.
Yes.
So a little bit later, a couple of minutes later, I hear the sound coming back up from the back gate, comes into the circle, circles it once or twice, turns it off, gets out, slams the door, looks at me, and he said, still drives like a truck.
That's hilarious.
From there, and the great part of the story is he goes upstairs. Calls down to Mary and says, I don't want to sell it.
I
had to take the sort of the self-blame that I cost him $500,000 in getting him excited about the car.
But how cool. He got so inspired, hopped in that thing and started
it
right
sentimental.
Up.
He was very, there's the sentimentality that he had that.
Mm-hmm.
He was sentimental.
Yes.
That was part of him. Wait a minute. And that's so cute.
The security, open the gate.
Everybody's like, oh my gosh.
He's leaving the property.
He's driving, you know.
That's wonderful. So, thank you for sharing that.
Yes. It's probably the first and only time he got behind the wheel in many, many years.
Oh,
right?
Can you imagine?
Everyone drove him
Absolutely.
Everywhere. If you think about it, yeah.
We'll have to share that story because we were in, Stephen Randall was going to come on, but unfortunately he was not able to. And he had a hysterical story about Hef hopping in the front seat of his Prius.
Oh my gosh.
And
in his pajamas with his.
Yeah. So they had had a meeting, right? A big editorial meeting. And it was him and Stephen Randall, Tom Stabler, Gary Cole, a couple other people from Chicago, and Huff. And it was this extended, you know, and he had his storyboards out and putting everything together and whatnot. And so the meeting was over and the guys were like, but we're going to just walk back to the Playmate house, you know, just down the street. So Stephen Randall had his car there and he's like, okay, well, I'll drive over there. And so Hef comes out and he's like, Stephen, where's Tom? There's a couple more things I want to discuss with the boards. And Stephen says, well, I'm going over to the house. And Hef goes, okay, and gets in the front seat with him. The boards in his pajamas. And Stephen's like, all he could hear is Mary going, what do you think? He's your little best friend. You can't take him off the property. And he took him off the property and
when
went over to
the house.
And then he called him and like, Hef's on the way, just so you know. And it was totally fine. Sure. And then him and Tom Stabler walked back to the mansion. Can you imagine? And he's in his pajamas walking down Charing Cross with his storyboards. Hysterical.
I love it.
Such a great story.
Do you remember the first time you met Hef?
It was that evening. But it was an interesting thing in terms of fate in one way.
Wait, that the evening of... It was at the
Playboy Club, but this was 1977.
Right.
But my wife and I, interesting fate kind of thing, went on our honeymoon to the Playboy Club in Jamaica. This was back when they had the resorts, mm-hmm. and so it was 1970. And while we were there, we paid the bellman or something $5 to take us up to Hef's suite.
Yeah,
and we went up there and. It was sort of a rooftop. You sort of had to enter it separately, a rooftop thing. And in the shower, there were crates of the small Pepsi bottles piled up. And it was like,
that's cool.
What are those for? And it would be, well, you never know when it'll come back. Mm-hmm. It's like, how many times has he mm-hmm. been here? Once, mm-hmm. you know, and wow. kind of like for the ribbon cutting. Mm-hmm. And so we had a sort of tour of that, never realizing that some couple of years later, I would be 5 feet away from Hef.
Gives me goosebumps.
You know, on a constant ongoing basis. And it was just kind of a funny.
And you realize he loved Pepsi. He only drank Pepsi.
Playmate of the Year shoot was in Jamaica. And
it was?
And this is the first time hearing that there was even a...
Yeah, I didn't know either.
A Playboy Club in Jamaica.
Resorts.
I mean, the company at Lake Geneva. There was also in Wisconsin. There was one in New Jersey and one that was there in Jamaica. And these were very... We were with some people the other night. And they kind of said, wow, it must have been really... wild and provocative, you know, kind of like a Sandals or something. It was like, no, I mean, it was really their target was really an older audience even. And beautiful golf resorts, you know, sort of nightclubs that were built into the resort. So it was quite different, I think, than the impression that people would have had.
Isn't it funny? We were talking about that earlier, how people get that impression with
across
Playboy, which it's fascinating. The more we speak to different, you know, the different prolific people, really, mm-hmm. like yourself, mm-hmm. that are behind what I keep calling, which is true. It's a living, breathing brand of incredible human beings. But he had class,
mm-hmm.
just really classy.
And people don't,
everything,
yeah,
and
they don't know.
They
that.
Have a different idea. And when you say Playboy, they just—it's always. Their mind goes to smut, and I don't know why.
Just like this that I just got.
Yeah. So it was never pornography. It was art. And then I'm sure there were the times of debauchery and his privacy or whatever.
Absolutely.
I don't.
Privacy.
None of my
or
business.
Private, his private life.
But at the end of the day, I think he really. We've talked about this before. He was so pro First Amendment rights. He was so pro-objectivity. Mm-hmm. He was so pro-privacy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And and that made it kind of, he was a very interesting, mm-hmm. it's above him, but probably in our, I know my lifetime, but in generations
forever.
Of American history,
forever.
One of the most intriguing human beings mm-hmm. with some of the most influential people mm-hmm. in history mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. that have been a part of Playboy in one way or another, and not even recognizing that the influence that he had on them.
Yeah.
Some people that have gotten their start in all kinds.
Because
we had Mickey Gilley on
yesterday.
Larry, Mickey Gilley,
from Playboy record label.
And he attributed his success, and here's an icon himself in country music, attributed his success to getting his very first record. Nobody else would give him a deal.
17 years.
Playboy Records. Yeah. And Echo and I had no idea. Yep. You know, we've been watching the Hugh M. Hefner.
The story on Prime.
On Prime. But at the end of the day, it wasn't until then that I had heard mention of it. Yeah. And then to be able to, you know,
to hear him say, and he said, he was just a gracious man. He said, I just really enjoyed meeting him. And I'm just so thankful for him. And
I wish I could remember. Go ahead, Corinne. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, you go ahead, Larry.
I was trying to remember the name of the documentary. So a lot of people don't realize that Hef was a real key underwriter of Now, the feminist movement.
Oh, yes,
was really,
absolutely.
I mean, you know, he was writing checks and supporting this. There's a great documentary. Again, I can't remember the name of it, but it really goes through all the things that he was doing in terms of, you know, Sammy Davis Jr. on his TV show, you know, among sort of, you know,
like
the
how
very
controversial
first, you know,
it was
Americans
that he was there with him.
He knew what was wrong and empowered people that had every.
If you look at all these different things, basically, sort of very much in terms of rights and a crusader. And no matter where you are in terms of, I'll say, conservative versus liberal, you have to sort of look at the, you know, the things that he really accomplished that are quite sort of separate, you know, in many ways. Yeah. If you think about in terms of a pictorial in the magazine, but he was very much of a pioneer in that respect and accomplished, you know, some pretty extraordinary things.
I always get goosebumps.
I know, me too. Just like nonstop.
When you look at, it was not Playboy After Dark. It was the Penthouse Playboy.
Black and white.
Yeah.
Yeah.
what was the official name of that show? Because Playboy After Dark was our
Yeah, I'm trying to think whether it's Playboy Penthouse or what, you know, I'm trying to
think. I think it was
blank.
Playboy what Penthouse.
Was it?
I think so,
it was Playboy Penthouse.
And which is probably why Larry Flint even called his magazine when he became
Penthouse.
The rival.
Oh my God.
I guarantee he just stole
ding, ding,
it
ding,
from
we just figure
that
something
show.
Out.
Because
there are a lot of imitators.
And none of them. And there are things that I learned in that documentary as well that just artistically, every magazine followed suit.
Absolutely.
Because the bar was so high with art and imagery
and writing and presentation and then the beautiful women that would just fall out into that trifold. Yeah.
The gatefold.
Oh, yeah, the gatefold. We forgot it was called that. And Arnie and David Meese were calling that. I was like, oh, yeah, the gatefold.
And you and your wife are still – so you were – married, had your honeymoon in Jamaica at the Playboy Resort, ended up at Playboy 2 years later, and you're still with your same wife?
I'm still with my same wife. She's here right next to me.
So how many years have you been married?
50 wonderful years.
Oh my God.
As of this year. So
that's amazing.
That's beautiful.
I love to hear that.
Love it,
yes.
Love it.
Amen to that.
I have to say something about, I mean, Lily, see, at the very earliest days, I mean, you could naturally, it could be threatening for a young wife in terms of what does your husband do?
Of course.
He's a photographer for Playboy. And Lily was able to come on some of the shoots where there was a comfort level. And she realized pretty quick in terms of the professionalism,
right?
As you well know,
right?
You two ladies well know. I mean, very much of a professionally run.
Oh yeah.
You know, a
big production
shoot in so many ways. And when I give various talks, and in fact, I give a presentation that's called "My Boss Wears Pajamas to Work."
Oh,
and then I talk about about my career, and Lily's often been in the audience, and so many people turned to her, women turned to her, would ask her, okay, what did you think of all this? And Lily has an answer that's kind of right out of answer that Hef often had, which is, you know, it's kind of a Rorschach test. Mm. You're sort of asking me, really sort of asking yourself and your own comfort level.
That is very
and your
true.
Own husband, what would be your comfort level? Mm-hmm. And she said, from my point of view, I understood what he did. I know him very well, very happily married.
Right.
And the other thing was, I think my role as the creative director was also a little bit different in terms of the responsibility, because I kind of felt like Uncle Larry.
Yeah.
Because when you think about the conferences and taking – I would take 25 or 40 playmates to Vegas, you know, for some of the video shows and things like this. And like my responsibility is, you know, the show must go on and we're going to put on a big event and there's got to be a trust factor that I have with all of you to be able to, you know, to be comfortable with me and for us to do the job well. And I think also with my relationship with Hef, I mean, it just, you know, no, that's out of the question.
You know what,
she's right here, and I love her so dearly.
Lillian, hi, Lillian.
Hi, Lillian.
We want to see
her. Yeah, they're saying hi. I'm on earbuds, so she won't be able to hear me. Thank you.
Tell her to wave at us.
And you know that you're speaking to a point actually that keeps coming up, and the comfort level, and certainly Corinne and I always talk about it, is how comfortable and safe we felt at the mansion. Always
the safest I've ever felt. Yep. In fact, and I felt like. The presence of true gentlemen,
absolutely,
including Hef, but Larry, all of us, absolute consummate professionals, and I tell people that I all the time.
That's all it was.
I was almost spoiled and doing all of those promotions and being so protected and. That when I went into the real world, because we all know
you were disappointed.
Like, my gosh, wow, this is horrible. I remember working for a photographer. I won't say who. Yeah. I won't. Yeah, but I worked for a photographer after I had posed for Playboy, that's the only nudity I was ever going to do. Done.
Yeah,
bam.
Exactly,
throw that one away. I've done it, and no one else. I would never do any nudity for anyone else. That said, I did a shoot and he was trying to get me, you know, he's like, you did
Playboy.
Because
they right away expect that.
You know, and he was the one that kept saying, you know, not to sound vulgar, Larry, but we were talking earlier, Lacey's here with us and she, you know, our bunny mom, but we don't like when people say titties. I don't like it.
Yeah, yesterday I said it twice and Lacey are like,
I just feel like it's just, and that's a personal preference, but I never had anyone speak vulgar or it was all class and it really was art and it was
just the next level. I mean, we were even talking about, so we had our makeup done by Playboy makeup artist, and after doing our centerfolds and then going on and working in the modeling world or the acting world, etc., I was always so damn disappointed when somebody would do my makeup. I was like, no, you're not doing it right. You're not doing the lips right.
Yes, you know? I don't look pretty. You look in the mirror, you're like,
I'm making my lips look small. I can feel. You got to make them bigger. It was so, you know.
But those are, you know, on every level.
On every level.
I think it's the same from, you know, the artistic end of it. Anyone that worked with Hef.
The editorial side
The bar was raised. Yep. And then going anywhere else, it was probably a cakewalk. Like we were talking to Michael Lee and he went on to have a wonderful career afterward, but wouldn't have gained the knowledge and everything, all of the expertise that he had.
Certainly not.
Had he not worked directly with Hugh Hefner.
Right. And that's what we can all speak to, you know, for any of us, anything that we're doing today, and certainly, you know, yourself, Larry, you know, it's such a byproduct of you being at Playboy.
Yes. And even when you put it behind you, because we all move on, we have our lives. Mm-hmm. I think now it's fun to recollect and say, wow.
And for us to also—
I was a part of that.
Yeah, and also to really have that appreciation and go, oh, wow, actually, I am the person I am today. I am doing these things. I'm doing all of this because of Playboy. And because I learned how to, you know, I became obsessed with photography. I became obsessed with all things skin. I was a skincare licensed esthetician. I became obsessed with marketing. I taught myself how to build websites. I was like the second, you know, playmate to do that. I write now. I mean,
social etiquette, travel etiquette, everything. It goes on and on.
And I didn't really have that foresight until just recently in my late 40s.
And I think we all, there's something unique about something that's so profound and big, and it is big, and it's the third largest brand in history that we know of, really. It's the most recognizable.
And like Disneyland and Playboy.
But how he said fate earlier. I loved how you said that. It was fate. It's like you were being prepared for it, because a lot of us can have a preconceived notion. I know I did.
Of course.
Before I became a playmate, I was offended because I had that same idea. And I was offended by my boyfriend at the time who said, I think you should be a playmate. And I didn't know what a playmate was. I just thought, no way. When he told me it's you know, Playboy, mm-hmm. I called my mom, Little Miss Self-Righteous. Dean thinks I should do Playboy. Can you believe it, Mom? That's awful. You know, I was 18, turned 19. But I have a similar story where I remember finding Playboys.
Of course.
The neighbor boys up the road had hidden them, and I put them in the basket of my bike, and I stuck them in there and rode to this little side street, and there was a hidden area with the light posts that I could sit in, and I sat there so no one could see me, and I remember pulling those centerfolds out, and to me, it was the most beautiful pictures I had ever mm-hmm. seen, and I didn't think of it as dirty.
You couldn't stop looking at it. You're like, wow.
And I was probably 10. Mm-hmm. And then a boy up the street, which is bizarre looking back, he goes, Karina, when you get older, you're going to be. And I didn't know what I didn't know what that meant. Right. He did this with his hands.
That's cool.
And I remember being upset about that. Yeah. Going home and saying, Mom, what does this mean? The boy said I'm going to be like this. And she laughed. And then my mother, who never swore from the South, never said a cuss word, she says to me, when we're at the grocery store, she looks over at me because she always secretly wanted to do Playboy. She admired the art.
You didn't tell me that.
I know. I'm thinking of this about fate.
I love that.
And my mom said, Karina, and I was about not much older than that. And not older. I was maybe 11. I don't know how old I was. And she goes, Karina, would you ever do Playboy? And then I'm like, because now I knew what it was. And I thought she was testing me that I had snuck and looked mm-hmm. at those pictures.
And you said no.
And so I felt guilty. I go, no, Mom, no, I would never. Because I thought she was watching me. You know, moms do. And then she goes, well, you should never be ashamed of your body. You have a beautiful body. And that's the only magazine. I'll never forget her saying this because I thought it was weird until I got older. And then I recalled that memory.
That's so
because it was profound as at that age for my mom to say, don't be ashamed of your body. Yeah. It's art.
Yeah.
And the only magazine, Playboy, is art.
That is so interesting. And thank you for sharing that, because my mother, I was discovered by Greg Gorman in a restaurant in Santa Fe. I was 18 years old, 2 months out of high school, and I was moving to Austin. And he always did these workshops in Santa Fe in the summer, and he saw me, and I was there with my mother and my high school sweetheart. And he invited us over to the table, and he said, I'm so-and-so, and I'm shooting a German Playboy, and I want your daughter to come and test. And I was like, nope. Absolutely. Nope. Nope. No way. And my mom's like, you are doing this. I'm driving both your ass there tomorrow and you're doing it.
So both of and our then, mothers sure enough, are who, yeah. Because that's what yep. my mom said yep. when I called her upset when Dean said, yep. you should do Playboy. She goes, Karina, this is a perfect opportunity
yeah, exactly.
for you.
You don't pass that up.
But it's one of those things where it was set.
Yeah.
It was almost like I needed to go through all of those things. Otherwise, I wouldn't have been prepared. Mm-hmm. I'd have been like, no, are you insane? Yeah. You know, and I was so modest. We were talking about, I used to cover my swimsuit
so
with a t-shirt.
Mortified that first test shot. I was like, oh God.
Sure. He had Heth laughed at mine and said I look like a startled fawn. Gary Cole said that he was looking. He goes, and he just starts laughing because I was terrified.
A startled
anyway,
fawn.
Anyway, Larry, not to talk about us. We're here to talk about you.
So there was something that you wrote that really it landed with Karina and I in a big way. And I just love the way that you said it. And this is something that we're asking all the guests when they come on. Is you know, what's the impact that have had on your life personally and as well as in your career. And you said, I would have my 1 p.m. calls with Heth, and when answering the phone, it was always like stepping up to bat at the World Series. And I was just like, that could not be, I mean, that could have not been said better. Mm-mm. And then the, where was that other quote that he said about giving the allowance?
So, loyal. I love it. Oh, the, sorry. The, I love how you say loyalty yeah. was of paramount was, yeah. importance.
Loyalty was of paramount importance.
And that's a given with all of the people that were there for years. Mm-hmm.
And so talk about that. Tell
loyalty
us.
Loyalty is
know,
a beautiful
tell
virtue.
Tell us more about, you know, working intimately with Heth.
Yeah. I mean, certainly the the phone calls at 1 o'clock. And this was back in the early days of cell phones. So I had this large brick and I'd be at a restaurant. And at any given time, I would expect,
right. They were huge.
You know, this call, you know, to come through and it'd go over, you know, he's looking at some artwork because, you know, most days I'd be sending artwork up to the mansion or pitching him on something. And there's no, I mean, he, you know, very much right to the point, he'd be looking at the artwork. It was always amazing. He would see something in the artwork that the rest of us wouldn't.
Sure.
And we'd sort of like, you know, smack our heads. It's like, how did we miss that? Mm-hmm. You know, and his impression of that. And the job was very much, it's like to listen to what he's saying. And then how do you go fix it? So typically so many of my responses were very much like, have got it. You know, you'll have another version tomorrow, mm-hmm. Kind of thing is, you know, to try and push perfection. Mm-hmm. And it was really taught me at those early days how to, you know, continue to push myself, my staff. I mean, I hired Michael Lee and Michael, you know, was fantastic. And Michael would always set such a high standard over anyone totally. That we hired, anyone yeah. that we would work with. And so, and for the rest of my career, that really served me so well. And if anything, I've actually, if you think about a pitcher who's got a pretty good fastball, but sometimes it's sort of like I would have to take a little bit off the fastball because I found other teams, other creative teams could not yep. hit that
they
level.
Get on board,
and it yep. was almost too much for them mm-hmm. to expect that, you know, to happen, to push them. And if anything, they start to take it wrong or personal.
Right.
It's not personal. It's just about the art, you right. know, and getting to that certain level.
Standard.
A little bit of theme in terms
of standard. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it was just the standards were off the charts. In fact, in the early days, we had to watch Money later. But in the early days, there was, you know, I had photographed with National Geographic and was looking at Life and Look. And there was no other magazine that basically, I never looked at budget. I mean, right. if I was in Alaska and I needed a helicopter to go on top of a mountain, which I did, then yeah, I just simply spent the money. At that
there
point
no
in those days, there was
spared.
No, yeah. you know, it was kind spared. Of whatever it took to, yeah. to make it.
Yeah.
On loyalty, it was interesting that I always felt, certainly as myself, like, am I an okay photographer? I guess so. But the difference there would be, if you look at all the people around Hef, I mean, it was a team. Mm-hmm. So certainly if you think about traveling, you know, you've got security, you've got mm-hmm. Mary, you've mm-hmm. got mm-hmm. a host of other people. And the presumption is everybody's pretty good. That's why you're there.
In that role.
But the other key difference would be the rest of it, maybe 75% of it. The rest of it was, do we understand we're here to make life work for him? And right. so if I'm there, there's an interview with the national network, they're coming in, I'm going to take photographs. The way the setup is, the chair is a little bit too low versus the you know, the talent that's come in from a network.
Right.
I could call down to Hank, you know, in the shop and yeah. say, basically, Hank, I got 5 minutes. Yeah. I need this chair 4.5 inches taller.
You got it.
And it would be done.
Yep.
And it was that kind of,
teamwork.
We can make this, yeah. this happen.
And being able to get along with everybody. I think you said that
that's,
as well.
That's
you
what
know?
It was. Because
this.
Often there yeah. was pressure.
Oh, yeah.
In terms pressure. Of, you know, it's just, you know, you got this group that's moving at times when we would travel, you know, sort of, you know, high rate of speed. We got a lot of publicity, a lot of things to do. And sort of interpersonal skills. And I think the yeah. ability to genuinely like, you yeah. know, the other people that we're all working together, understanding what we're here to do,
definitely.
You know, in consort together. And that, I think, was really a lot of the key. Mm-hmm. Certainly, I think, in terms of my tenure there and, wow. and the others who were with them for so many years.
Yes. And what a great and fundamental trait to have as a human being. To take that away, because that helps you then in all types of relationships, you know?
It does. But you teamwork, know? I think of how
that's
how,
huge.
I think of how Hef knew who was playing
right.
what
yep.
position.
Yep.
And he would move yes. people to the right position.
Mm-hmm.
But because he saw their worth and he knew, okay, they may be on first base now, but I'm seeing them. Mm-hmm. I'm seeing mm-hmm. them as a catcher here,
uh-huh. exactly.
and he would be able to do that. Like it's a beautiful thing to really look back and see. And earlier we were talking about how he wasn't an emoter. He was a thinker, like you said. You don't take things personally. Mm-hmm. I mean, yes, there's going to be the times where he was disappointed or would
sure.
lay into
sure.
somebody, but it was always warranted. It was almost like yeah. the, like, okay.
And then it was
no,
over and done.
Yes, and it's done. Mm-hmm. You don't dwell. Mm-hmm. You don't sulk. You don't, it's, okay, we're moving right along, yep. and there's a bigger picture, mm-hmm. and it's, you know, there's a bigger picture.
Exactly.
But
I'll share with you something on that. I mean, remember, again, we have a psychology major here.
Oh, yes,
and,
yes,
and,
yes.
And so, you know, I think the way he would actually work with people, when you say the word disappointment, right, that was really interesting because and a little bit of inside baseball here, I had a brilliant father, but also a very demanding father and tried to, you know, sort of meet that standard. And in my own interactions with Hef, there was very much of I won't quite say this father son, but it was very much all Hef had to do to say on the phone was just say, I don't think it's quite right. I think we can get better. This is what I'm seeing. All he had to do was raise an eyebrow.
Right.
And because of my own life experience, it would be, that was all, I won't say it's traumatic, but it was almost like, that's all you got to say.
Yep.
And exactly. I'm going to do my best to make this correct.
Clear.
With others, I'm sure he would have a firmer, you know, a firmer approach. And I've spoken with people after just getting off the phone with Hef, who I know.
That are ready to cry. Yeah. Oh, my God.
They were crying. And I know what they went through.
Yeah.
In my own particular case, and I appreciated that with him, that he didn't need to ever go to such extremes.
It wasn't a personal thing towards you. It was about what the creation was.
It was, Echo, but it was also interesting. It was personal in this way, that he understood that about me to the extent that would be all it takes with Larry is just to say, Larry, I think we can do this.
The way he conveyed it on you.
It's like, I'll leave it up to you. Like, you know, go make it happen.
Yeah.
It's like, you better believe I'm going to go make this, you know, this happened to try
knew
and,
you.
You know,
he
meet
knew,
that standard.
Yes, he knew that about you. He was very good with people and reading them. I told you how he had no idea that my grandmother collected dolls, loved dolls, and I'm very close to my grandma. She's in heaven now. But that said, when he called me a Dresden doll and he had that twinkle in his eye, like, he just knew things that about each of us.
Yeah.
And he was able to pull what was special.
Yeah.
And like he knew that. And you had probably spoken to him, you know, about whatever you did. He doesn't forget. He had he just had that photographic memory and was a thoughtfulness and knew how you worked, how each person worked. That's what I mean about putting them on the right position on the team.
That that voicemail that that you shared with me, and obviously Karina and Pat Lacey have listened to it, and the way that he spoke in that was like, okay, well, there's just a couple, you know, little tweaks here, and if you have some time tomorrow, Larry, you know, please call
that
me.
Respect.
Yeah, yeah.
He demanded respect without demanding respect.
Please do, because we love that.
Yes.
I mean, two stories on voice calls. One of them, there's another one where he starts off and it sort of goes on for a minute and a half. He's going, Larry, I'm thinking black, and I'll use this kind of, you know, it's without specifics. I think black, you know, I think black, I'm really think black, but I can kind of see sort of maybe the gray, but then, you know, there's a lot to be said sort of for the white and then maybe the white and all this. And so, you know, if you'll take care of it, click.
Yeah.
And people would listen to that. They'd say to me and say, what was it? What did you do across that? And I said, well, I think that was part of it was working with long enough. You would know, I know what he's saying.
Yeah.
I know what he wants. But one other story on phone calls was, I had moved to Oregon sort of the last 2 years I was with the company, and he was very supportive. It was great because he could reach me at any given time. Mm-hmm. And so on a Saturday, I've got the family in the car, sort of my daughter's junior high school and my son, who's probably maybe 9 or so. And we're in the car. We're ready to go take a trip. And then so my son says, I forgot something. And I'm kind of getting impatient, you know, let's sort of go. And he goes, I'll be in the house. I'll be right back from the garage. He runs to the house. Minutes pass and he comes back and I kind of go, what kind of took so long? I thought you were just going to grab a jacket or something. He said, well, I was on the phone. Who are you on the phone with? Hef.
That's so rad.
What did he say? What'd you talk about? He said, well, he wanted to speak to you, you know, if you're available. I said, okay, what did you tell him? I said, Dad can't talk right now. He's in the car. We're going to the mall.
That's adorable.
And then at that point,
I said,
yes. What did Hef say? And he said, oh, okay. We'll tell him later when he has time. Give me a call back.
So I love it.
He was
so thoughtful.
It was very, very sweet. So
very sweet.
And the kids basically, you know, when they were growing up, we would go to the mansion and you can imagine, I mean, a zoo with over 160 different species there. And so the kids would play with the squirrel monkeys and it was a zoo for the kids.
Yep.
They would just have a blast growing up.
Absolutely.
I always
beautiful.
Feel like our children are so blessed and fortunate to have
I
had
never
that
took
experience.
My daughter.
Great.
Yeah. But yeah, it's
and the game room was pretty cool.
Oh, that was so the best. Right. That was our fave. That was our fave. There, I found out that they're keeping the zoo up on the property there, and it's like one of the only properties I think, like in the, I don't know if it's in California in the country that has an actual zoo license. So they've kept all the animals.
Yeah,
up there.
He was at that time in L.A. He was I had to have a personal zoo license. Right. There were four full time. Zookeepers, and there's a term for that, but there was basically four full-time people who worked across all the different species.
Wow.
And what they did was they would actually do trading with other zoos. So there would be certain exotic birds, and there was actually a program between the different zoos. So here's half a private zoo. He's working with the St. Louis Zoo.
How cool.
You know, all these major cities. And at one point, Steve Curry, part of my background, National Geographic, Steve Curry, one of their well-known photographers, Steve was going around the world photographing sort of exotic animals and species and mm-hmm. some extent, you know, private. And so Steve came to the mansion, spent the afternoon. We went around and he photographed these really sort of exotic, you know, animals that are not very, very common.
No, they're rare.
And separate from all the different areas where they were, I'll say displayed again for cages, lack of a better term, but basically, you know, in the backyard, there would be Ethiopian crown cranes running
right,
at one
exactly.
point. There was, you know, emus
exactly.
sort of running and through.
And you would never think about it. The nocturnal, the room. Yes.
And you would never think about it because you're like, oh, it's just the mansion or about the cost it would have for a party or anything. And now it's just we're getting so much more information of like, oh my God, I've never
we went into
about
it.
Probably,
so he made a contribution there to wildlife and to rare
to
animals. I'm sure he's made all kinds of.
You can't take this personally, but I have to tell you one playmate story.
Please do.
Who she would often say and she was terrific. I won't mention her name, but she was often would be, you know, she would call security and say, we got to tighten up, you know, security. Cause I noticed every time that, you know, every time people drive out, the back gate's always open. Mm-hmm. And of course that's where the security shack was. And they would see a car coming, they would open it. But in terms of all the animals and thinking about them everywhere,
right.
There was one afternoon where we it was a holiday, had a big event. There was a volleyball court set up in the grass. And then somebody noticed and said, my gosh, look up at the tree. And then something that was about 4 feet long was a huge bee's nest. It was massive and growing by the moment. And so someone calls, you know, security and the groundspeople. It's like, let's all step away from this. You know, let's be careful.
Yeah.
And she looked up at it and just kind of said, well, you know, I don't know who decided to let the bees out today. And so the idea that they were probably somewhere, also stored somewhere else.
Yeah,
he probably had his own honey. Yeah. No one knew about it. Hef's honey. Just keep that in my hidden area in the kitchen.
Which Karina knew where it was. She'd go get those cookies.
Yes, I used to sneak into that and his special cookies, I still need to get that recipe from Brian. I finally tracked that down. I'm so happy.
Yeah, we do need to contact him for that.
Oh, my
Thank
gosh.
Thank you for sharing that.
Can I ask him what
you
I ask
him whatever
everyone?
You want, honey.
So I always ask this in terms of if you were saying what you wanted to say to Hef in memoriam, or almost like a eulogy or just
or the last time you saw him and knowing it would
something
be,
that
what
you would have liked to say to him or attribute to him.
Ooh. Yeah, I think, you know, my great gratitude would be that he allowed me, to share so much time with him.
Nice.
And if you think about, you know, everything sort of the celebrity and his life, his world. Mm-hmm. And actually, after about a year after I left, there was one of the volumes that came out all about Playboy, a very large volume. And he graciously sent it to me. And on the inflap, on the inside, he wrote, you know, thanks, Larry, for joining me in the journey.
That's
awesome. Hef. Wow. Mm-hmm. And so I think that on the professional side, you know, really being forced to learn what I would be capable of in terms of, I'll say, creativity, you know, and professionalism and try and hit a certain high watermark. in essence, he gave me a life in terms of, I mean, I photographed most of the Playboy interviews at that time. So going to the car races with Paul Newman. I'm having tea in the afternoon with Betty Davis. I'm going on tour with Linda Ronstadt.
Wow.
I'm with Dudley Moore at his house, and he's playing on his grand piano while I'm sitting there. And so if you think about, you know, sort of all those experiences that I was allowed to have, and again, just being next to him and his confidence in me in terms of, you know, trust. I would just, you know, all of that. It was really an amazing, you know, I consider myself, there's this little kid from Shreveport, Louisiana, and how I ended up here.
Yeah.
But we'll forever be grateful for all of that.
It's wonderful.
I love that. Bill Farley earlier, we asked her, Karina asked the same question. And he said kind of like, oh, well, and he said, I think I just would say thank you. And I was like, that's awesome. That's perfect. It's like, what else can you say?
Thanks. This is our thanks.
Yeah.
Three words that describe Hef.
Certainly perfection. So I've talked about that, you know, a great deal, and myself and everyone that was part of the journey, you know, around him at that level. We also know that's another thing we've talked about, you know, sort of was loyalty. And I know there were often times with Mary, you know, there were people who she could smell if sort of they had their own agenda, versus Hef's agenda.
She sure
and,
could.
And that was a big difference, I think, in terms of and my wonderful relationship with Mary, that she knew always I was going to be looking out for Hef. Mm-hmm. And that would be, you know, we'd be in a meeting and somebody would look to compromise the quality. And my role in that meeting was to go, we're not going to do that. Mm-hmm. At one point, it was interesting, Hef. We're on a Saturday, we're at the mansion, and across the floor, we've got all these photographs. We're going over some covers. And Hef said to me, he said, Larry, this kind of gets me to think about it. He said, Larry, you have to understand, I want you to have my mantle. You know, I want you to be able to, when you're there in those meetings, you know, you're representing me.
That's huge.
In terms of that standard.
That's
so huge. Again, loyalty. I think the other thing would be certainly visionary. And we've talked about, you know, all the things that people don't recognize. I mean, certainly one, creating a men's magazine that became, at that time when I was there, the second most recognized corporate symbol in the world.
Sure.
If you think about sort of the impact in terms of society, if you think about, again, it could go on and
just
on.
Exactly.
You know, people who sort of look at his life and look at the things that he was able to do. And I think the other thing would be, you know, you could certainly look at him for those 12 pages of nude in a magazine, but I think you have to really look at, you know, sort of, you know, more
the
rounder
full context, yeah.
You know,
it's
aspects
very important
in terms of, you know, what his life and so there, I'll stop there.
Thank
on my three words.
I know it's a hard one. I like ending it with that though, and it's pretty, everybody's pretty much along the same line. I mean, loyalty definitely keeps coming up, but I really like visionary. That was a good one as well. Thank you so much for being.
Yes.
And as I think I mentioned to you as well, we are coordinating and we are going to put together a huge celebration of life
for Hef.
Event for Hef.
We'd and love all the family,
all
to
of
be
the
together.
Playboy family to be there, and the Playmates and the staff and
in
everybody.
His honor, the
in
way he
honor.
Would yeah. have had a kickoff
exactly.
party,
exactly,
just in the way he did it.
So we're gonna make that happen. It's very important, and just more and more that we just keep talking to everybody.
Well, thanks to you both for reaching out. It's really been a treat to be here with you today. I'm so thrilled that you're able to reconnect with so many names that are bringing back such great memories
to
me.
Larry, it's so good.
And I can't wait to see the, can't wait to follow the series.
Oh, well, it's so great to see your face. I mean, all of this has been...
It's just
the reuniting. And then as soon as I see you, it's like no time has passed. Even though so much time has passed, I can picture you. You know, I have these memories that you forget,
and everything keeps getting
until
sparked.
We're sitting. Yeah. Yes.
So just we are so extremely grateful, and thank you to you and to everybody that is has been willing and coming on and sharing their story of
really
of
paying
the,
tribute
of,
yeah,
of
to
the incredible
someone that impacted
Hugh Hefner,
all of
and
our
who
lives.
He was and what he meant to all of us. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Larry.
All right, honey. We'll talk soon. Have a great day.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.